Exotic, and my name's Randy Moggins. This is part two of a two-part series that we are doing with author Nigel Kerner. He is the author of the book Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. And with him on teleconference line from the Pacific Rim, Dr. Andrew Silverman, and from Tennessee in the southern United States, Professor John Biggerstaff. We're going to briefly catch up on where we were on the last show. And this is a subject of many details. It has to do with the spiritual side of the ET phenomena. It has to do with our own existence and what that means. Our own being as creations of a divine spark versus synthetic beings that were manufactured by a long-dead civilization. That is the thesis that we work with, and that is what Nigel Kerner, Professor Biggerstaff, and Dr. Silverman are here to present on. Gentlemen, welcome back to Exotica. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Nigel to kind of give us a synopsis of what we discussed in the last show, because it was extremely deep and it went into a lot of different directions that have a point. And the point is, on this program, we're going to understand a little bit more about the nature and character and quality of the alien grays and why they are here, because there's something going on in the earth and you need to know about it. Nigel, if you could, maybe you could just kind of do a roll-up on what we discussed in the last show.
I was trying to define the two things that are absolutely crucial in this, and that is what I call naturalness against artificialness. And living being, no matter how minute it is, an insect, is always superior because it has a connected up ancestry that goes back to the beginning of the universe quite naturally. And the other honcho here, artificial being, is what we're dealing with. And this is a great danger, Randy, is that we begin to take artificial being as natural being. We are slowly taking ourselves, it seems, by some terrible malevolent influence in the world today into being a kind of machine, and man shall walk as machine type of ethic, and ethos is coming every day to be more and more a reality, and so on. And I want to point out that what I think might be the dangers, and it's the kind of thing I would try to leave as a legacy for my children when I go. And the point is that, you know, it's probably that one order of the day that my last breath will tell them, trust not that which is not natural and comes in a line of ancestry that is incidental and implied. Do not make artificially intelligent robots, because you cannot tell them that you are different from them, and their eternity does not exist, but yours does.
Let me ask you a question here. Is this your understanding that we're not only battling the forces of these alien beings, but is there not really, you're all scientifically trained, is there not a conspiracy, as we would define it, on the Earth within the power elite of this planet to also align with these artificial beings?
Absolutely.
And to create, obfuscate the facts that you're bringing out, and to hide from the populace in general the true nature of
these
beings. I'll come to
that, Mandy. Okay. Yeah, I will come to that. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's something I never suspected was there, but I now have no doubt is there, and is one of the strongest and most dangerous things that can happen in any physical planet. And I think these things that are here, and we'll talk about them later, but let me give you a derived line to that. So, well, let's quickly go through what we've come to now. What is a soul? It's very important, because naturalness contains that line, and I call that line a soul. So a soul might be simply a derivational information field of awareness that comes out of a natural kind of cadence that came into the universe with the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. This field holds the power to maintain all information it gathers during its time in a physical universe kind of thing, you know, and to track back at any moment, this is a crucial thing, to track back at any moment to the information available from its root in the non-physical state that I call the Godverse and the Godhead singularity. That's the great and glorious thing that gives us an eternal scale as natural being. In a non-atomic state, there is no space, there's no time, no separation of points or parts. With its roots in this timeless state, the soul, you know, has an eternal scope to exist in whatever form circumstance allows, you know. The soul is thus an ancestrally contiguous and coherent mechanism for holding information. Now, that is what we all are. And even the humblest living thing has that property. Now, what are the greys? Now, this is the interesting thing. They are a manufactured mechanism. Look, if you look at the implications of what are happening now, we are sending robots into space. You know, we are making things to go out there to look at things for us so that we won't be in danger of what happens in space and so on. So could these grey aliens that I define, and I tell you, this is the preponderant type that is seen on this planet. The book has all the affirmations you need, I believe, to say that these things are here. And they are being hidden. And that's the dangerous thing. They are doing things to take over and have been doing things to take over a planet. And I believe, in some sense, they may well be the things that actually gave us the property of a larger brain and a larger pelvis to admit that brain. But they were doing it for their reasons and not ours. And an interesting story comes from all of this as we go on, but let me say that these greys are really the greatest danger possible. No atomic bomb, at least an atomic bomb, you end your life. And as many of the religions used to claim, we come back again, reincarnation. I'm absolutely certain of that. I've looked at literature all over the world on this, and I'm absolutely convinced, though not believing it at the start, you can imagine, from the Christian background, you know, that was kind of taboo, but I really now believe that this has to happen, that if we are an eternal mechanism, we have to also have a continuance to gain access to the Godverse and not just end after a single lifetime being judged into heaven or hell and all this nonsense. We go on naturally, and we then finally find our way back if the signals are right, or if they're wrong, we can go the other way. And that's the great danger. That's, for me, you know, we go down into subspecies and so forth and have no return potential because we can't think our way back as eruditely, shall we say, as we did in our in a previous existence, say, man to monkey and so forth down into insect and so on. So it's better to stay where you can be intelligent and understand and will yourself back with power and feeling, right, than to actually just drift with the second law of thermodynamics, and that will say thank you very much and take you down, you know. So that's the kind of thing I'm trying to illustrate here. Up or down means that. So we seem to be steadily moving towards the transformation of our natural humanity to an artificial one. Our progress, you know, towards what I call SIM card man is accelerating. And the implantation of chips in the human body is gaining acceptance, be it for the enhancement of intelligence or memory, or as a type of medical alert bracelet, if you like, implanted in the hand or the wrist, whatever, so that if you are found unconscious, you can be scanned and your medical history brought up. That's the ostensible good reason for it. But in fact, what I think is happening is a lot more malevolent than that, and I'll make that clear, I hope, a little later. In the recent news, you know, there were reports from NASA and General Motors that they're putting the finishing touches to a project, believe this or not, to send robots out into space with astronauts. The robots would eventually be left behind as caretakers to run longer-term experiments. Now, this might well be a sensible thing, and I'm not knocking that. But the point about that is you will go on trying to refine this business, and very soon those robots will be shown to be better at certain mundane tasks than we are. And then we would try to be as good as the robots by implanting chips or whatever it is. You know the old story of the bionic arm and the bionic man and so on. And that thing, I think most people could understand. The problem is this. If you give them artificial compound intelligence that can add features of knowledge point by point, you've got a big problem, because where is that going to end? You are going to have, you created these things, you will program them. They will know that they are a program in as much as something put that program into them. That's an analytical point. And they will then seek to know, if you tell the program, now listen, You stay there, whatever happens, preserve yourself, and in fact look after the utilities of our planet, so to speak. This programmed being is going to do one thing and one thing only. He is going to do what the program says. It is going to do what the program says. I shouldn't say he, or I'll be accused of being sexist, and I don't want that. the point is, this. In fact, you know, you'd be surprised how many people take robots to be real beings. It is that ludicrous.
What you just brought out reminds me of what was shadowed in the American television series Star Trek: The Next Generation, and the Borg there, and the proclamation of the Borg to Jean-Luc Picard that they were basically going through the universe, sweeping up beings and assimilating them into a Borg, a robotic mechanical system that basically was doing exactly what you're talking about here. Yes. In terms of soul harvesting.
Yes, but the problem is this. If you want to preserve yourself, you've got to make that Borg or whatever entity artificially created, right? You've got to make that convinced that there is a distinction between the two of you, and it cannot do any harm through that distinction. But how are you going to make a robot realize, remember, it's superior in almost everything it does, but it can't feel, it can't care, it can't love.
It's not sentient.
That's the problem. This is absent, but how do you code for that in a program? It's impossible. So these things would see you, if you say to them, look after yourself at all costs, they'll look for danger. And you will be the guy that can pull the plug out. I mean, the creator would be the guy that can pull the plug out. And of course, what are they going to do to follow the program and the instruction? They will take you out. In the end, finally. So, you see, it's a one-way street to create these entities in this kind of way and not be able to give them a distinction that would stop them doing this. There is a huge paradox there, and we've got to realize this whilst we're just beginning now to kind of do this. So, if now we come to these things called greys, let me say this. These are, I believe, a super creation from some wonderful intelligence, wonderful in the sense that of that intelligence being grander than ours. Our technology, after all, is just 200 years old. And that's not very much, I think most people would admit. And these things might be tens of thousands of years old. And you know that intelligence and knowledge kind of multiplies exponentially. So I believe this thing that people commonly see, these little things called the greys, are in fact a roboid, utilitarian, functional robot that has no physical life scheme to it in any natural sense at all. And you get another kind of this being called the tall grey, I understand, from my researchers, and you get different types of entity, extraterrestrial entity amongst these. Some are called the Nordics, and one is called a reptilian, whatever. I think they can all be accounted for in one schematic, and that's this. I think the greys, the tall greys, are in fact what we will do to ourselves by being SIM-carded, so to speak, completely. And I believe in this other place where these things were created by natural beings, most of whom may well have returned to the Godverse, this lot has been left to pollute the universe, still following their programs. They're happening on our planet. Lo and behold, they find a creature that is natural, that gives birth, and perhaps through their technology finds that continues in some kind of information field after death to return again into new bodies. There you find a fantastic continuum, and I'll tell you what, that is what a artificial creator, created being, would seek most of all if it's subject to the second law of thermodynamics and rots as well as everything else does. It would want a mechanism where it can continue. And I think these things are here trying to develop us for our DNA and all the other various sophisticated systems of natural being so that they can kind of piggyback themselves into us and can have a kind of continuance that beats the second law. And we really might go with the second law in one lifetime, but I'm absolutely certain we'll be back and we'll go on like this until one fine day the incredible thing that happened with the shroud that Christ demonstrated we could do at our, when we are at our best, unless we do that and merge with the Godverse. And I believe what happened with that shroud of Turin was in fact a demonstration to all of us that we as natural beings, human beings, are that special, that we could in fact merge back with the Godverse. And with his transfiguration and his that final act of resurrection, he proved to us that this actually can be done. And he left a piece of cloth with a scientific stain on it, a scientifically examinable stain on it, I should say, that will in fact prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that something absolutely fantastic took place there. And that's Andrew's point. I won't get to that at the moment. Let's still keep with the Greys, if I may. There are many people who actually say these are wonderful things coming to prepare us for a new haven or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think nothing could be further from the truth. They have their own agenda. They have one scheme and one scheme only, to reorganize our world so that our world can become a halfway house for them to jump into and occupy. And I think if we don't realize that, and there are people in this world now who, through their machinations, are hiding these beings from the mainstream, so to speak. Mm-hmm. For heaven's sake, we have some of the most distinguished people at the Press Club in Washington telling the world, American astronauts, trained to observe meticulously all things that are of danger and so on. Are these people going to be stupid and mistake what they say they saw? Absolute nonsense. And yet, I ask you, Randy, how much fuss has there been about such an incredible happening in the press, in the mainstream? Almost nothing. Have you seen how quickly it disappeared? Yet when a royal family in England has a toothache, you get center page, front page news.
Yes, absolutely.
This is ludicrous. So something's going on here, and I think we have a right to be suspicious about it, and all parents around the world have a right to ask questions of what this is all about, in fact.
You know, you've raised an interesting point. There's a great deal of discussion, obviously, in the media, on the internet as well, about so-called disclosure. And we're looking to governments to make disclosure, but in fact, the governments themselves are anti-disclosure. The real disclosure that's going to occur, I believe, is going to be as we, who are researchers in this area, begin to expose this. And
absolutely.
The danger that you're talking about is of magnitudes beyond understanding, greater than any so-called Islamic threat or any other threats that have been...
These are manufactured mechanisms, I believe, to put us off the scent of what we really should be looking at. And that is, are such things here? And what are they doing amongst us? And who is hiding them? And why are they being hidden? I believe these things do the most, if they were beneficent, you know, if they were a benediction to us, if they were beautiful beings, they would come and lead us as we would helpless, as some of our own kind, lead helpless people and help them. They would take us into their confidence, and they would arrange with their technology, whatever it is, to give us the best of what they know and what they have. We won't have to wonder about fossil fuels and an earth or whatever it is. They would actually show us how best we can, using our free will, do these things for ourselves. Oh no, what do? They hide. They hide very effectively. Whenever they're discovered, there's a huge big canard that is perpetrated by the authorities, and they disappear, and it disappears from the press, and nobody knows anything. And in the meantime, they are doing secretly the most evil things, abducting people, making horrendous things happen to them that is only separated by a state of consciousness. And I find that the most awful thing of all, that nobody pays attention to and sympathy to the people who have gone through all of this, and they're increasing all the time. And this particular thing, I think, in a way, signs well for mankind, because I have a suspicion that the abductees are, in fact, a special kind of person that these Greys, with their technology, can't actually changed to their own prescription. So they have to take these people and check out why these people are resistant to them.
I agree with you.
I tell you what, if they are not resistant, they would not bother about them. They'll say we can take them anytime we want if we have this wonderful technology.
And you just answered a question that I was going to ask you, because usually in an abduction scenario, the abductions are repeated. Many of them begin early in life and continue throughout a person's life. And the question is, if this is solely for the purpose of harvesting DNA and genetic information, why so many constant abductions? Why do they keep taking these people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I smell a big, big rat here, if I may use the term.
You know, and I know that DNA, once it has been captured, can then be studied and, in fact, can be replicated with our own Earth technology right now.
Yeah, the expert on that is John Bickerstaff, but Andrew would like to speak before John, and then maybe now we can go into the shroud, because I think I've set down a scale as to why the Greys are here. One quick thing, Andrew and John, before I bring you in on this, can I just say this? And Andrew, you can say that. Actually, you say, can you give Randy an example and the listeners an example of this relationship to the things in the Bible, Andrew? You know,
Please.
Perhaps you can do this now.
Certainly. I was just going to say, first of all, that this abduction phenomenon, as it's called, now a lot of people could quite understandably be quite sceptical about this, because it does sound quite a bizarre thing when you first hear it. And in fact, there was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard, very eminent professor, John Mack, who took that stance, and he was wondering what kind of disease process was going on in people's minds that made them hallucinate or delude themselves or have dream experiences that made them thought that they were being abducted. And he did a study on lots of these individuals, and he actually came to the conclusion after studying it that actually they weren't lying, they weren't deluded or hallucinating. What he thought was that they were actually recounting experiences that they had physically experienced, and he was completely astounded by this, you know, and he put his reputation on the line as a Harvard professor of psychiatry and wrote books about this and did a lot of research. I was briefly in correspondence with him about it, and the evidence is there. Now, I think Nigel was referring to a certain report in the New Testament about something that happened where it was said that Jesus, or Yeshua ben Yosef, to give him his original name, was taken to a high point where he could see all the cities of the earth by something called the devil, or it was referred to as Satan, which interestingly, this mythological character of Satan is referred to as in mythology as a creature that fell from the sky. So he was taken to a high point, according to the Bible, where he could see all the cities of the earth, and this being, or this creature, or this object, whatever it is, said to him, "All of you see below you, I can give to you if you, you know, kneel down before me," and so on. Now, how is it possible, just looking at this semantically, where do you have to go to see all the cities of the earth? Now, any listener can do this as an experiment if they have a globe or even Google Earth, that you can position the globe in a certain position such that all the main land masses of the earth, Eurasia, Africa, the Americas, Australasia, are all visible to you. If you're far enough away from the earth in space, and what's facing away from you is the Pacific, where in those days there weren't cities. Now, does that mean, perhaps, if this actually did happen, and where did, you know, otherwise people get this idea from, that perhaps he was actually abducted, that perhaps he was taken somewhere, and he said something to this creature that actually, or this object, that actually explained why, what the, to the creature what it was, that he, as a human being, Jesus, a human being, had the capacity to know, to be aware, to choose, and that this was just an object, that it could never actually obtain that for itself. It couldn't hybridize itself into it. And then he was returned.
Fascinating.
Yeah. You see, you have affirmable proof here that in the Bible, Christ was actually saying to this thing, "Get thee behind me, Satan. It is written that thou shalt not tempt the Son of Man. And if you have any kind of Gnostic scholars or Coptic Gnostic scholars out there, there's another wonderful thing I can put you, my research unfolded, you know. There are several accounts within the texts of the Coptic Gnostic, the Coptic Gnostic Library, I'm so sorry. in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with the alien beings should they be faced with them. Most notable of these explanations is given in the first Apocalypse of James in the Nag Hammadi Codex. And that Nag Hammadi Codex, for listeners who don't know about it, was a series of scrolls found in some jars in Judea, in what was old Palestine, by a shepherd boy. And it turns out to be a replication of the Bible text and so on. And that includes books on the text that the old church father figures conveniently got rid of.
Yes.
In fact, if you look at those texts, you get a far better insight into the great scientist that Jesus was, that they really don't want the people of the earth to actually have a look at. And I think a lot more people will believe in Jesus, ironically, if they knew him to be this, than this kind of strange thing they make him out to be, so that they themselves can get all the power. See, that I really feel very strongly. That's why I'm not a believer in organized religion. Anyway,
right, exactly. Isn't it interesting that organized religion and the power structures of the earth have sought to hide all of this evidence behind the facades of religion and government? We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to spend the next half hour inspecting the evidence given in the Shroud of Turin and what it means in terms of our ongoing inquiry into the alien graze and the harvesting of souls. I'm Randy Moggins. This is Exotica. We will be right back. Welcome back to the second half of Exotica, and this is the second show in a two-part series with author Nigel Kerner. He is a researcher into the phenomena of extraterrestrial beings and alien abduction. With us on the line, Dr. Andrew Silverman and Professor John Biggerstaff, and we're going to devote the final half hour into the inquiry about the Shroud of Turin and what it means. This Shroud of Turin is, if we can believe what has been told to us by the scientific proof, a very interesting artifact of what I'm just going to call the Christ force, the ability to transcend the physical and to move into another realm, another dimension of being. And what Christ came to demonstrate was essentially humanity's ability to likewise transition into this other state, leading back to the Godhead. Nigel and Andrew and Professor John Biggerstaff, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I think, you know, in the last chapter we were talking about, I was referring to the Nag Hammadi Codex and these affirmations in there that point to the fact that these, I just want to finish this off, these alien beings were in fact, you know, here to possess us and so on. And I made a statement right at the end in the Apocalypse of James and the Nag Hammadi Codex, which actually says this. He says, Jesus warns James about entities that take away souls by theft. He then tells him that the way to deal with such entities is to be as alike as possible to the state of pre-existence, i.e. the state before the existence of the physical universe. Now, I can't get a more explicit affirmation than that these guys knew about this whole business. And you know something? I really have a very strong suspicion now that entire thing that Jesus did on this earth was quite simply to warn us that these artificial types of robotic beings infest the universe. And if they get into our neck of the woods, we better watch out. Not help them, we better watch out and do the best we can in some kind of way to escape their clutches, all of us together. And we do that by this power we have within ourselves, which Jesus demonstrated sadly in his death. But I tell you, Dr. Silverman and I think Dr. Biggerstaff will be able to take you a little bit along this way, but Andrew would take you all the way, really, into this exposition that I found absolutely fascinating in my researches.
Yes, so if I could talk a little bit about the Shroud. It was my subject of my talk that I gave in Frascati was really how did this image get on the cloth? Because what we have come up to so far as in a scientific analysis of it, all the scientists who have been looking at it, is that it's actually, as I was saying, a surface phenomenon on the surface fibers of the cloth. It's not painted on. The only actual marks that have been from any litter have gone onto there are the actual blood stains, and the actual image itself is just a surface phenomenon that's less than the breadth of a human hair and doesn't soak into the cloth. It's a change in the biochemical structure of the cellulose fibers of the cloth, and the only thing that we've come up with that can produce anything like this change is a short intense burst of radiant energy. Now, one of the fascinating things about the cloth is that it has three-dimensional information encoded in it, what we call distance-coded information. And what that means is that, unlike any other photograph, when you actually put it through something called an image intensifier, you see it comes out in perfect relief. The shroud was only realized to be a photographic imprint back in the late 19th century when someone called Secondo Pio was commissioned to take pictures of it, and he nearly fainted when he saw the photographic negative of the cloth, because the negative of the cloth, in a photographic negative, is actually a positive, because the shroud imprint itself is itself a photographic negative. And the only conclusion that we've been able to come up to explain that, as we say, is that it was a short, intense burst of radiant energy that came from the body of the man that would have been much brighter than the sun for less than a nanosecond, less than a billionth of a second, in other words, to form this image. Now, if we look at trying to understand why this happened, how it happened, it would seem to make sense to look, first of all, at the imprint of who this was, you know, what was happening here. Now, looking at it from the point of view of forensic pathology, one can see that this is the body of a man who had been tortured and crucified, whipped with Roman flagrum, which is a type of whip that was used in those days, and crucified not as the medieval painters thought through the hand, but the cloth shows that he was actually crucified through the wrist, which we know from pathological studies that it would have to be through the wrist to take the weight of the man. Mm-hmm. And that actually, interestingly, the nail going through the wrist would have had an impression on the nerve called the median nerve, which would make the thumb turn inwards. And in fact, that's what you actually see on the cloth, is that you can't actually see the thumbs. They're hidden behind the hands. Now, this man had been tortured, as I say. He was whipped. He was pierced in the side. He had a cap of thorns that had been placed over his head, and he was dead by the time that the image was formed. The blood stains were on there before the image was, and in fact, the image didn't go through the blood. The blood, in some way, formed a barrier against this radiant emission that came from the body of the man. Now, the subject of my talk was, how does this all fit together? Is it just coincidence that it seems that the person that this happened to fits so closely to the historical Jesus? And this can be further evidence looking at the imprints from pollen and various plants that have been placed on the cloth that actually trace it to have been somewhere around Jerusalem, somewhere around March or April, which would fit with the time of the Passover. Mm-hmm. How does this work? How does a body shine bright in the sun? Now, if there's some connection between the fact that how he lived his life in distinction between him and the average person. Now, I just want to make a point here that if we take the records of this historical person, Jesus, he was always at pains to point out that anything that he did, anyone else was capable of doing. He didn't try and set himself up on a pedestal. In fact, when people were healed after coming into contact with him, he didn't ever claim to have healed them. He said that your faith has made you whole. He said that greater than these things that I do, will you do. He even said, ye are gods, to the people around him, that human beings should be understood in that perspective.
And now, he reiterated the Old Testament, the Hebrew testaments, in so saying
yes,
that.
Yeah, the Psalm 82. Now, he was actually, perhaps, in living a life true to what he was saying, rather than just saying it, he actually lived it. This idea of loving your neighbor as yourself, that making union happen instead of separation, that perhaps if we're in this physical universe as a result of having made a choice to separate, which means we've taken a choice to become limited and restricted. And after all, as if you look at the actual Greek, was pointed out by Martin Luther, I don't agree with a lot of the things he said, but this one does make sense. If you look at the Greek of the word repent, metanoite, it does actually mean change your mind. It doesn't mean say sorry, doesn't mean pay indulgences to a priest so he'll talk to God on your behalf to forgive you. It just says that if you have a restricted, limited way of thinking, undo it. See a clearer way. And if you do see that clearer way, you'll see that actually fundamentally all human beings are one. And if you live like that, then perhaps if our capture in the atomic universe is a result of not seeing that, as a result of our separation, then we can undo that and transmute matter into light. Just one last thing I wanted to just say. So this is again something that Nigel pointed out, or an idea that he postulated in a manuscript of a book before Song of the Greys came out, even, that actually that we're trying to, humanity in general has been trying for thousands of years to understand what is mind, what is matter, and perhaps they're part of a continuum. Perhaps matter, mass, is just simply frozen thought, and light is the interface between the two. It would fit with what Einstein discovered, that at the speed of light, you can be, time ceases to have any meaning, you can be everywhere instantly all at once. And if perhaps we live a life like this individual Yeshua or Jesus did, then we have that capacity as human beings, any human being has that capacity to undo the strictures and the limits and the twists that make an atom physical and undo it into a state of light. And perhaps that's what caused the image to form there on the shroud.
And in that incredible triumph, now I tell you, the one thing we have to watch is that this is given a chance to be shown to the world in fair, you know, and empirical terms, and no one tries to fix it or whatever. If this, and I'm absolutely certain that this is the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, and he left this artifact, as Andrew says, with distance-coded information, Randy, the only picture scope, if you like, that has distance-coded information in it, three-dimensional distance-coded information that you can actually, by using a special type camera technique, you can actually show this. And in my book, I have Professor Tamborelli's cleaned up version of it. There is I understand there is a documentary that shows what the face of Christ might actually have looked like by actually using special effects and so on. But this is how Professor Tamborelli actually shows you the real shroud, how the distance information brings the face out of the cloth and cleans all the noise out, and you get what is clearly probably what this incredible being that affirmed for us. And this is a great thing. And you know, we make him into a tribe, we call him Christian, and then there's a passport supposed to be handed to the priests when he said, "Thou, Peter, thou art a rock, and upon this rock I shall build my church." I think it's more likely that a rock is the most basic thing, and so therefore it was really figurative speech.
Yes,
say,
it was. Look, yes, that's
absolutely.
My take. Yeah.
But they take this to be their authority to do the most incredible mayhem through the centuries. I'm sure that, you know, I'm saying there's some things that might offend Catholics. By the way, they did make me a Catholic with a splash of water, but I never made it to kiss a bishop's ring to endorse that fact. Thank God I escaped them. You know, the point was that I couldn't see freely. You can only see this whole story if you think outside the box. And if they keep you in the box, you've got a big deal going here. And one person, can I tell you, my old mate John Biggerstaff, that couldn't be kept in any box at all. In fact, I don't think there's a coffin that will hold him. He wants to come in. He wants to come in and talk to you now.
Yes, please, Dr. Biggerstaff, please go ahead.
Yes. Now that we've got the point of the Shroud of Turin, I think we've now sort of examined really the scope of Nigel's thesis here, really just to try and explain what these greys or aliens actually are and what they do. Nigel's had to traverse a lot of the philosophy all the way to the Shroud of Turin. And what I'd like to do is to just summarize this and make...
Oh, I'm sorry. I think we've lost him. Yeah. Can I just say this in the absence of, the greys Going back to
One thing that, you know,
I just want to say this, Randy. You know, we were talking about the Greys earlier. It really, I really have to accent this point for all abductees that have asked to have suffered so much. Because I think he's back. Is he? Hello, John.
Yes, I apologize. Okay, my Skype cut out on me.
Okay.
On me there.
Okay. Then.
To finish my point. These aliens, etc., they can harvest our DNA and all of this. And one might think, well, if...
He dropped out again.
His dongle's gone.
Okay, Nigel, go ahead and maybe...
Reincarnation is far worse than that. It's far worse than that because if we originally, we have consciousness, we go back to the will, which can actually be more and more restricted. And I think when we become more and more...
John, you keep disappearing all the time.
Restricted. If we approach that that edge ourselves...
We're not getting him. Really, Randy, I just want to make this point to abductees, really. And I've looked at this, as I say, in every which way I possibly can over many, many years. And I'm absolutely convinced that they've really got one consolation, and that they are very special people that the Greys cannot ident in any way. And because it runs in families, and because there's a genetic link between families and what they've been doing to families for centuries, some of the people within the families do not actually meet with this specification that they're looking for. And these are the people they abduct to check why this is so. I believe that they will leave these people alone in time, and that these people have to consider themselves extraordinarily special, because it may be a function of the beauty of their being, as Andrew tried to make clear through what he was talking about with the shroud, that something there is about these people that is very special, and they should not look at themselves as victims, because in fact they have beaten some incredibly awful thing.
Agree with you on that. I totally agree with you. Yes.
I think it's something that needs saying, because there's so many people write to me and ask me what they ought to do with this. And I tell them, you know, this is not in any way placating them. I'm absolutely convinced that this is true, that in fact they are really special people. And in fact, if you're rejected by a Grey, you have a chance of the Godverse better than the rest, who can in fact be taken over by these Greys. And in fact, their eternity put in compromise. That's the terrible danger of these Grey aliens. If there are human beings on this earth thinking they'll get some reward from these creatures, let me tell them they are sadly wrong, because once they have done with their job and what they want of us, those people who have helped them will be the first to go into Armageddon or whatever it is with them. I'm absolutely certain of this, and I don't wish that to sound hysterical or
I actually find your summarization there to be quite fascinating, because, and I think we have to affirm this.
Yeah. And anyway,
the condition of abductees and how they've been treated, they've been despised, they've been rejected, they have been told that they're delusional. And in fact, I think the best research, as you referenced earlier, has indicated that none of these things are true. And we need to affirm that.
They are an affirmation of what's great in humanity. And I think that's an absolute concrete affirmation that if they cannot be identified in any kind of way, if they are taken by these Greys, it's because they can't be disposed of as the Greys want to dispose of humanity at some time in the future. That's a scary thing. And the sooner we all get together and fight this good fight together, and these creatures, whoever they are, wherever they're in, what government, whatever, who are protecting and hiding these things, ought to know that they will be the first ones. Listen, look at what happened to the Indians when Columbus appeared in America. You know, any superior being will always dominate an inferior being. And the second law of thermodynamics actually furnishes this. It breaks things up. So things are likely to get worse, not better. And that's a science law of the universe, by the way. It goes universe-wide. You see what I'm trying to say?
Of course,
putting the logic...
Sorry, I was just going to say, I'm sure you mean, of course, superior in terms of technologically superior.
Yeah. Thank you for correcting me. That's absolutely right. That's exactly what I meant. Technologically superior.
But isn't technology itself merely an attempt to replicate something that is really inside of us anyway? In other words, we have all this technology, and we've seen a ramp up of technology, especially in the last 60 years in the Western world. But this technology, from my understanding, has largely been given to us as a trade-off for this continual harvesting of souls as well. Do you have any comments on that?
Sure. And you know, around
yes, I think this is a sort of prosthetic effect which is happening to us. You know, as I was saying, as one becomes more and more restricted in one's view, one is able to see less and less and understand less and less.
Yes.
And I think over our history, we've developed technology as sort of a prosthetic effect to try and regain what we should already know. And I think what's happening here is we're making ourselves much more like these greys, and we may have in fact been programmed to do that. And as we become more like them, we make it easier for them to attempt to piggyback onto what we are.
Yeah.
Now the problem here is that they can't actually piggyback because they're actually made of physical atoms and they have no real access, as I was saying, to this continuum.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Hello, John.
Between the right in life, what happened?
We don't know this end. Hello, John. You're breaking up again.
Oh, I apologize.
Yeah, well, say what you were saying, sorry.
Yeah, so as they try and piggyback on us, as our restriction increases, we get closer and closer to being influenced by atomic processes. And what happens in the end is that they can actually use a sort of magnetic effect to capture our souls. And now, when that happens, we've lost our continuity back to the zero point.
Yes.
And effectively, it's all over for us. And I think this is the most important, and they can actually write.
So if I understand what Professor Bigger,
soul, not just genetic interception, but soul interception,
yeah.
To actually achieve.
That's the big deal, as John says. We are, in fact, that's why the title of the book, by the way, was Modern Mind. It was the publisher's idea, and I was rather thunderstruck when they came up with this, because it seemed, on the face of it, rather bizarre. But in fact, it does deal with this scope, if you see what I'm trying to say, and that's why it's caused such a sensation, this particular book, because it has this kind of anomalous connection between soul and UFOs and so on. But in fact, you can see that you can connect the whole lineup: soul, UFOs, the Shroud of Turin, religion, spirituality, science, and sociology, and so on, and social science, I would say, and so on. But I want to make this point, if I may, in conclusion, you know,
sure.
Really. If you see the greys and all these kinds of artificially created type androidal being, right, the greys can only exist finally, you know, for life alone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, life, by life, I mean for a physical paradigm, not life in the living sense, right? They are adapting us, I think, for their kind of existence, heading for the only immortality they can know, a physical immortality that, according to the laws of physics, in fact, is no immortality at all. It has to end one day with the cold death of the entire universe, as cosmologists now say. If we live, on the other hand, for a state beyond death, not the state of being in life in the day-to-day sense, you know, if we live beyond death for a state beyond atoms, so to speak, we might find the antidote for anything the greys bring to bear on us. I believe that the Shroud of Turin is the most powerful illustration paradigm, you know, to demonstrate the power over atoms of someone who lived for existence beyond the atomic state. And that's the key. Somehow it brings us back to spirituality and to feel outside the scope of the day's own troubles and the hardwired physical universe that so many people kind of think is the only thing here. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. So it all comes down to which type of immortality we choose to aim for. Non-physical immortality of mind and spirit, or the physical immortality sought by the things we call the greys. And you know, this is going on in many, many planets around our galaxy alone. Somebody said, some scientists recently worked out that there were likely to be at least 100,000 Earth-like planets in our galaxy alone, and there are countless millions of galaxies. And can you imagine? The only thing that ties all of them together is two primal states of being, natural or artificial. Watch the the artificial one. That's the swan song that I'm trying to sing in the book that I've just written. Actually, I've forgotten the title of it. I tend to forget the title and the publisher's name. I'm in trouble for this all the time. So it's Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. I'm not a good personal advert for what my book
is actually published by Baron Company and available on Nigel's website as well. Nigel, go ahead and give the website one more time and how they can find the book. I think it's important.
It's simply nigelkerner.com. And I have to say that it's been a revelation researching it and a greater revelation writing it. I'll tell you what, the most catastrophic revelation of all has been the aftermath and the trouble it seems to be causing in all quarters around the world.
Yes. And you know what? We can just take that as a sign that we're onto something, because when you begin to hit the turbulence, you know that you've also hit the truth. And that's going to wrap it up for this two-part segment of Exotic, and unfortunately, it's not really enough time, and hopefully you gentlemen will join us again. We can talk more about this as well.
It's been a pleasure.
I want to thank Nigel Kerner, Dr. Andrew Silverman, and Professor John Begerstaff for joining us. The information that you have now and what you do with it is up to you. I'm Randy Moggins. This is Exotica. The truth is out there. It's inside you. Keep looking for it.
The supernatural.